Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. It is August 29th, 2013 at 9 a.m. We're continuing our two-day agenda, and we're back to number two on the agenda, which is to review the interest rate assumptions. So let's start out with Mr. Martin.
Yes, members. In your package, you should have a memo from me dated August 21st. At this point, I'm not going to go through it in any detail. I'll just give you a general. It's here to, like our normal memos when we start a project, is to give you a lot of information that's basic to the topic, and that's the point of this memo. I would draw your attention to page 3. The reason for this topic, as we understand it, is this general uncertainty or queasiness, potential queasiness about whether the interest rate assumptions that we're currently using in our Minnesota public pension plans are the correct interest rate assumptions. On the bottom of page 3, I've given you a laying out, an identification of the interest rate assumptions that are currently applicable in state law. Minnesota is relatively unique in having both select and ultimate assumptions and pre- and post-retirement assumptions. While we think of these things as a single rate proposition, it's more complicated than that. I will point out that the commission and the legislature has only very irregularly changed interest rate assumptions. Before 1969, the interest rate assumptions were 3%. In 69, they were changed to 3.5%. In 73, they were changed to 5%. In 84, they were changed to 8%. And in 89, they were changed to 8.5%. Then in 2011, the select and ultimate assumptions of 8% for 5 years and 8.5 thereafter was set forth. When I was thinking about this, it may be helpful to think about this in the context of how we were looking at the investment markets and how we were valuing assets. Up through 1984, Minnesota public pension plans recognized assets only as book value. We didn't incorporate any portion of market value of assets until 84. And then from 84 until sometime later, into the later 80s, we were only looking at book plus one-third of the difference between book and market value. So to the extent that the interest rate assumption had anything to do with actual investment performance, it presumably was a recognition of what was available as dividends and interest on debt securities and not market appreciation. So to the extent that that may help, these are the actuarial assumptions that we currently use. I'll pull in other parts of the memo as the discussion goes on, and it may be appropriate. Now I think it would be a good idea to have the various testifiers be given an opportunity to tell us what they know and what advice they can provide us.
Mr. Martin, could you explain on page 3 on that same chart what it means that there are different rates for pre-retirement and post-retirement with some of the plans?
Senator, members of the commission, the pre- and post-retirement actuarial assumptions are really a way to implicitly have a post-retirement increase assumption. I can explain historically, and it may not be a good idea at this point to do that, but our post-retirement increases came out of investment earnings way once upon a time, and that was always keyed at 5%. The difference between the pre-retirement and post-retirement actuarial assumptions is really standing in the place for what would be the actuarial assumption for cost of living increases if we had an explicit cost of living actuarial assumptions. That's the simple explanation. I can go into, if it's of interest, how we got there, but that's what it really does. There are a few other pension plans that do have pre- and post-retirement assumptions. I spent some time trying to identify interest rate assumptions somewhat broader than what the National Association of State Retirement Administrators information provides, and I only found a few instances where that occurred, and there are also only a few instances that have select and ultimate mm-hmm. actuarial assumptions. So we're outliers in that phenomenon.
We're outliers or we're unique?
Well, yes, we're relatively unique, yes.
Any questions for Mr. Martin? Okay, then let's start with our testifiers. And first we have Laura Kalambadkidis, our Minnesota State Economist. Welcome.
Thank you.
I can just barely get my tongue around the Greek because I was originally Panagopoulos.
Well, thanks for the effort. Should I go ahead?
Oh, please proceed.
Senator, members of the commission, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today about the rate of return assumption for Minnesota's public pension plans, an issue of importance to all Minnesotans. You should have in your packet my slide set, and I'll try to remind you which slide I'm on at each point here. Let me start by noting that
just
while—
Just repeat your name for the record, please.
I'm sorry. I'm Laura Kalambadkidis, the state economist from Minnesota. Let me start by noting that while I am a public finance economist, I'm not an expert on public pensions. I'm neither an actuary nor an accountant. I'm also not a stock market forecaster. Fortunately, you have access to experts in all of those areas, so I don't think it would be helpful for me to use my time today to wade into their territory. What I thought might be helpful is for me to do two things to try to inform your decision-making with regard to the rate of return assumption. One, to present some data related to U.S. economic growth, and two, to summarize the consensus among economists who have written about public pension rate of return assumptions. So if you turn to the second slide, the one that's titled Expected Rate of Return Assumptions. The expected rate of return assumption is typically used to compare present-day value of pension assets to future pension obligations. First, the rate is used to project the future return on pension fund assets. That is, it's an estimate of how much the fund's investments will earn in future years. Second, the rate is typically used to adjust future pension liabilities to present-day value. Because money paid today, of course, is worth less than money in the future, converting future payments into present value requires reducing or discounting those values. In addition, discounting all pension obligations to present value provides consistent comparisons of benefit payments that don't occur at the same time. So payments that occur in multiple periods in the future all get discounted to present value, and you can then compare across them. So if you turn to slide 3, let me talk first about the first issue, which is forming an expectation of future fund performance. As I said, I'm not a stock market forecaster. I'm also not an expert on the allocation of assets within Minnesota's pension fund portfolios, which, of course, will affect the expected rate of return. Nevertheless, it's fair to assume that all other things held equal, the future performance of the economy will influence the expected rate of return. While the economy is currently experiencing modest growth, we know that changes in the economy have combined to form what we call the new normal, and you've all probably heard some presentations about the new normal with regard to the economy. You've heard about the aging of the population and the related slowing of workforce growth as baby boomers retire. I've added a third challenge, the economic risks arising from persistent budget deficits. These factors combined lead us to expect a more uncertain future with modest expectations for economic growth. The adage that past performance does not guarantee future results is as true as ever. The next slide, number 4, the first chart, shows the annual percentage change in U.S. real GDP going back to 1985 and forward to 2040. using IHS Global Insights long-term trend forecast. So the dark bars are actual values. The gray bars are that long-term forecast by Global Insight. It shows that U.S. real GDP growth is expected to average just 2.5% per year over the next 30 years. So that's the dashed line on the right part of the chart, well below the 3.1% 20-year average prior to the Great Recession. So that's the solid line on the left part of the chart. On the next slide, we illustrate a similar forecast for inflation. Significant increases in inflation could lead to larger nominal returns on debt held by pension funds. However, this chart, also using Global Insights' long-term trend forecast, shows that inflation, and here we've measured inflation by the percent change in the consumer price index, is expected to average 2% annually over the next 30 years, or the long-run steady-state rate of inflation determined by the Federal Reserve. So again, that's the forecast is the gray bars. This is somewhat less than the 3% average between 1982 and 2012. On the next slide, we show federal budget deficits. So again, turning back to this, the new normal idea, the new normal issues. Federal budget deficits depicted here as the annual federal deficit as a percentage of GDP are projected to increase over time due to added pressures from an aging population and rising health care costs. So in the near term, 2013, 14, 15, 16, the deficits are projected to fall, so they're shorter lines below the zero line, but then they're expected to increase again, and they remain in the negative territory. And rising federal debt arising from these continued deficits could have serious negative consequences on long-term economic growth. So no one can predict the future with certainty, and long-term economic forecasts like these come with all kinds of caveats. Nevertheless, looking forward, we do not see a reason to dispense with caution regarding raising the rate of return assumption. So let me turn now to the second role of the rate of return assumption. This is on the next slide, the one that says two leading approaches. And the second role is converting future pension obligations into present value for reporting purposes. This slide describes two leading approaches. You're all familiar with the first one, discounting future benefits based on the expected return on pension plan assets. As explained in detail in the Commission staff memo that Mr. Martin just described to you, the memo for this meeting, this is what Minnesota does now. And it's consistent with GASB guidelines, at least the guidelines prior to the recent recommendations under GASB 67 and 68. The idea behind the second approach is that a certain payment is worth more than an uncertain one. If you're certain that you'll have to make a particular payment at a future date, then its present value is not that much different from its future value. Therefore, you need to discount it by a lower risk rate to bring it into present-day terms. If there's a chance you might not have to make that payment, you should discount it more, lowering its present value. The more certain you are that a payment will have to be made, in the case of pension payments, the more guaranteed they are, the lower the rate of discount should be. This approach, which the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office calls the fair value method, reflects the standard financial and economic theory that streams of payments should be discounted at a rate that reflects their risk. In the case of state pension funds, the risk is the level of certainty as to whether the payments will be made. A May 2011 Congressional Budget Office report contrasted the two approaches this way, and I'm quoting from that report. By using the expected rate of return on assets as the discount rate for converting future benefit payments into today's dollars, the GASB approach essentially assumes that those returns are as certain as benefit payments. By contrast, the alternative or fair value approach views the returns on assets as more uncertain than benefit payments. And that ends the quote. So they're saying the return on assets is more uncertain than the benefit payments, but at least it accounts for the different risks associated with investment returns and benefit payments. The implication is that public pension obligations, which carry strong guarantees, should be discounted at a rate that reflects the very low risk that they will not be honored, at least according to this approach or this proposal. Among economists who study public pensions, there's little agreement about this basic idea, the basic idea that the stream of payments ought to be discounted by a rate that reflects its risk. However, a variety of institutions and authors have weighed in on which specific rate should be used to convert pension liabilities to present value for reporting purposes. So in the next chart, the one with that's titled Select Discount Rates for Measuring Pension Plan Liabilities. In this chart, we present a range of those rates. So a range of rates that have been proposed by a variety of authors and institutions who have weighed in on this issue. In each case, we present comparable rates based on the author's descriptions, going back to 1960 and forward 30 years, converging to what IHS Global Insight believes to be the long-term equilibrium rate that would accompany full employment growth. So again, it's that long-term trend forecast. The top line represents Minnesota's investment return assumption. And we know, we just heard from Mr. Martin, that that assumption is not a single rate. It's multiple rates. We have the multiple rates for different funds and also the before and after retirement rates. But to simplify, we've presented a single Minnesota investment return assumption, which is consistent with that pre-GASB guidance that we described in the prior slide. So we've got it steady at 8.5%, dropping to 8% for the five-year period we're in now. And then for 2017 and beyond, we show both the 8 and the 8.5% rates. Next below that, the pale dotted line that levels out at 6.7% is the taxable yield on AAA municipal bonds and represents a concept similar to what the Congressional Budget Office prescribes for a fair value approach for discounting pension liabilities. The darker dotted line below that, leveling out at 6%, is the yield on high-grade corporate bonds and depicts a rate similar to that used in Moody's Investor Service's new methodology for analyzing and comparing state and local government pension liabilities. It also reflects standards set by the Financial Accounting Standards Board, or FASB, for private sector defined benefit pension plans. Finally, the dark solid line ending at 4.3% is the yield on 10-year Treasury bonds and depicts a riskless rate approach recommended by some experts. Let me be clear about two things regarding this chart. The economists' or fair value approach separates the expected rate of return on assets from the rate used to calculate the present value of pension plan liabilities. The rates in this chart are all the latter. So they're proposed discount rates for calculating the present value of liabilities. They do not imply that fund assets are expected to earn only those rates of return. And second, while current levels of the low-risk rates lie below the assumed 8.5% line, that's not always been the case, as you can see from the chart. As Alicia Minnell, director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, writes, the issue with choosing a discount rate is not whether liabilities should be larger or smaller, but whether they're measured correctly. So while there is a consensus among economists that the discount rate on future pension payments should reflect the riskiness of their obligations, there is not necessarily agreement about how to implement such reporting. For example, discussion continues on the degree of riskiness of public pension obligations, which, of course, will vary by the state's institutional arrangements, since there is some research that's specifically focused on that. And even if the degree of riskiness was well understood, our last chart just illustrated that there's disagreement about which rate, if any, mimics a particular fund's riskiness. Authors also disagree about whether a single rate should be used, or a series of rates that match the term of specific payments, that is, an entire yield curve. Because market rates of return change over time, the fair value approach implies that the investment return assumption would also have to change. But the Commission staff memo for this meeting lists a number of reasons why such frequent changes in the rate assumption are undesirable, and that's from in Section B of the memo. So because of this disagreement about implementation and the various other complications and implications of such a decision, it's important that this research and the accompanying discussion continue. If you turn to the next chart, or the next slide, one on the impact. It's important that this research and the accompanying discussion continue because getting the discount rate wrong has consequences. As you note from the know from the Commission staff memo for this meeting, and now I'm paraphrasing from Section C, the goal is to ensure that the generation of taxpayers that were served by public employees appropriately fund benefits accrued by those employees, or I would say earned by those employees, without shifting costs to future generations of taxpayers. A rate that's too high will understate liabilities, and all other things equal, will push costs to the future. On the other hand, a rate that's too low, that is, one that assumes a greater degree of certainty than actually exists, will overstate liabilities, imposing unnecessary costs today. So turn to the final slide. The Commission has a very large number of factors to balance in making decisions regarding the sustainability of Minnesota's public pensions. There's even in the single decision about the investment rate of return assumption, there's a very large number of factors and implications to balance in making that decision. Today, I've introduced only two of them, which are summarized in the final slide. First, uncertainty about near-term economic performance suggests caution about raising the assumed investment rate of return. Second, a common view in economics and finance suggests a fair value approach to calculating the present value of lower risk pension obligations. I hope the Commission finds this useful, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Senator Thompson.
Yes, Madam Chair, and Ms. I'm going to try to get this right. Kalambokidis?
Kalambokidis.
Wasn't even close. Sorry.
That's okay.
Pleasure to meet you, by the way. So if I'm understanding it correctly, then we are potentially assuming way too – that's an overstate. We are potentially assuming too high a present value on investment returns because we're not factoring in risk that those investment returns won't come through. Is that fair?
Ms. Kalambokidis.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Senator Thompson, the idea of the fair value method is that you should discount this stream of obligations by a rate of return or a discount rate that reflects its riskiness. And so if that stream has low risk, if you think that they're guaranteed, then the discount rate should be low, and a lower discount rate relative to a higher discount rate is going to lead to a higher present value.
Follow?
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then if we were to increase the rate of return assumption, in order to achieve that, we would have to get presumably into riskier investments, right? If you're trying to get an 8.5%, 9% rate of return, you have to take more risk than if you're trying to get a 7%, 7.5%, 8% rate of return. So if we increase that projection, then we expand the potential error in our present value calculation, right?
The economics approach and the economists who write about this separate – those two questions, the question of what should the investments be in and what the rate of return is expected to be on those investments from the discount rate on the stream of future investments. So the economists who write about this have said that the discount rate on the future obligations should reflect the risk of those obligations regardless of how those obligations are funded.
Thank you.
See, he's confused.
Could you, like, give an example of distinguishing between the two?
Another way to think about this this discounting issue is to think about from present day, you want to understand the present value of that those obligations you have going forward. And so for taxpayers today, they want to know how much do we owe in present value terms, or how much does do the funds owe in present value terms. And so
a future obligation in present value.
That's correct. The future what's today's value in today's dollars, today's terms of all those obligations we have going forward. And of course, calculating the obligations themselves is a major complication. but one way to think about it would be if someone were to purchase that stream of obligations, like I was going to invest and buy the rights to the stream of obligations, what would I be willing to pay for them? And if you had, say, multiple streams of obligations that were exactly the same workforce, the same payments due at the same times, but they were backed by different governments, different government entities with different institutional arrangements, then you would be willing to pay different amounts. They would be worth less to you if they were backed by an entity that was unlikely to meet those obligations. They're worth more to you if they're backed by an entity that are likely to meet those obligations. Mm-hmm. That's the essence of the discounting with regard to risk.
Senator Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. Clearly, Stinson was a little bit easier name for us to remember when. However, I do welcome you to the committee, and I do have a couple of questions on some of your assumptions that going back to your slide where you're talking about the average of 3% inflation and then a prediction from about the 2014 time forward to 2040 of an average of 2%.
Yeah.
And the question I guess I have is with federal deficits at almost $17 trillion right now, Congress grappling with how much money do we need to do to raise a debt ceiling, the Treasury Secretary telling us that we're going to run out of money by October. So that's a very real issue that Americans seem to deal with as this time of the year, every year, in the last several years anyhow. One of the ways that $17 trillion and mounting debt could be dealt with in an economy is to monetize that debt, which tends to create some inflation impact. And if this country does do monetization, I question whether 2% over a 30-year period of time is an accurate assumption. And if so, that would really mean that the underlying economy would be horrible in the face of inflation to hold prices down in other areas. I'm just wondering if you could comment on the components that went into that 2% assumption.
Ms. Kalambakidis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator or Representative Driscoll, and members of the Commission. A lot of things in that question. The interest rate assumption the inflation assumption is, again, this long-term trend forecast that is assuming we've reached a long-term equilibrium and full employment growth, and that the Fed is simply holding inflation at that level. So there are a lot of things that could happen in the future that would change this, including the response to the deficit and reaction to the deficit that you're talking about. In terms of federal fiscal policy and risks associated with that, we do have both some important near-term risks in terms of the raising the debt ceiling, the expiration of the continuing resolution, and possibly a budget government shutdown as a result of that. We have issues of uncertainty related to Fed action and tapering, the taper talk that we're hearing about these days. So those are short-term risks, and those would affect short- to medium-term assumptions about the economy. And then in terms of long-term risks, I agree. We have some significant long-term risks regarding the persistent federal budget deficits in the debt and not knowing exactly what's going to happen as a result of that.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, in your summation, you've indicated that uncertainty about near-term economic performance suggests caution about raising the assumed investment rate. Would we reduce risk if we were to actually lower that from the 8% that we were at now and maybe go to something, and I'll just throw a number up, 6.5% or 7%? Because, and the reason I ask that question is I think I heard in your comments earlier that managing that discount or managing that rate is a very important thing to get it right. Mm-hmm. So that we don't have other consequences that are around that. If we're at 8.5%, 9%, to what Senator Thompson was saying, that means we have to swing more toward the fences or throw Hail Marys, depending upon which sports analogy you want to use on this. But if it's down at around 6.5% or 7%, it's more of a conservative approach. Yes, there are other inputs that have to be addressed in there, contribution rates, et cetera, payment rates and the like. But would a lower rate of return that the State Board of Investment has to swing for, do Hail Marys with, going to be better in the long term, given our economic conditions and the uncertainty is always out there, but the great uncertainty that we have, as we were just discussing with federal question marks, deficits, those kinds of things, budget deficits.
Ms. Kalambakidis.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Representative O'Driscoll. As I said in the beginning, and I, or well, both maybe the beginning and the end, there are you have a very complicated task here, and there are a lot of issues that you need to balance. And so what I'm trying to do today is to present just two of those. And that, yes, we have uncertainty with regard to economic performance, and that does suggest caution with regard to what you assume about the rate of return on fund assets. And then the second, of course, is the separable issue of at what rate do you discount. But there are a lot of other things to consider as you make this decision, and the implications are far-reaching and, as I said in the beginning, affect all Minnesotans.
Madam Chair, if I can have just one more follow-up question at this time. Would you, and I trying to get bright lines on some of these things, because different members and those who are here today have different experiences and right. understandings of this, and you're correct, and I agree wholeheartedly with you. This is very technical. And issues that we're looking with, and trying to simplify this just a bit, could you, as the state's chief economist, give us some kind of an indication as to whether you think the last 30 years are more of a federal risk as it comes to uncertainty in the economy, where we're at with budget deficits and things, and then the next 30 years, are they equal risk in your opinion, more risky from the last 30 years? More risk coming in the next 30 years, so that we can take that into consideration when we look at those unknowns.
Look into your silver ball, Ms. Kolomakidis.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, I don't think I can give you an answer on that, on whether the last 30 years have been more or less risky. A lot of things have happened in the last 30 years, and a lot of them were unexpected. And even in the last 20 years, a lot of things have happened that could not have been predicted, and clearly were not predicted. So, is looking forward into the crystal ball more uncertain than looking forward into the crystal ball would have been 30 years ago? A lot of things happened that no one expected. So it was a pretty risky bunch of decades that we just went through.
Keep trying.
If you don't mind, Madam Chair. I'm finding that economists are as elusive as politicians. With that being said, given what we know today about the next 30 years, looming budget deficits, uncertainties of that nature, would you, in advising Minnesota on its approach with pensions and other, how would you have us value or approach risk?
Ms. Kolomakidis.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission. I presented the slide that describes the new normal, the changes in demographics that are really important, the persistent federal deficit that is really important for the United States. There's a whole lot of other things that come into the new normal, including the financial market crash and what's going on in developing countries and what's going on in Europe and all of those things. So it's not called the new normal for nothing. It's new. We don't know what it's going to mean. And, you know, we're doing our best to keep our eye on that and keep our eye on the horizon and try to figure out what's happening next. But experts all around the world are trying to figure out what the new normal is going to mean. And bless your hearts for trying to figure it out here in this commission.
Okay, thank you. Any more questions? Representative Khan.
Yes, I thought there's been some talk at some point that the CPI ought to be reevaluated for retirees, that it's not quite, that they don't really have the same, they have different sets of expenses of the general public. Is anything being done with that? And what direction would one think it would go?
Ms. Kolomakidis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Representative Khan. I haven't looked at that recently. I don't know the details of those conversations. It does sound familiar to me, and it does make sense to me that the CPI is kind of a blunt instrument and does not take into consideration the nuances of the expenditures of different groups of people. With regard to retirees, which direction would it move? Thinking on my feet here, they generally have lower expenditures in general. They tend to expend more money on services. They tend not to have lower housing expenditures, as far as I understand, but medical care matters a great deal to them. A significant portion of their incomes go toward medical care, and we know that inflation in medical care is higher than almost anything else. So if I were going to think through that problem, those are the things I would be considering. It's the best I can do at this point.
Okay. All right, thank you very much. Let's move on then to Mr. Bicker. Okay, welcome to the commission. And how much longer are you going to be, I won't say with us, I'll say at the legislature.
Madam Chair and members, it's down 2 weeks. About 6 weeks.
6 weeks.
How many sandwiches?
Plus or minus, depending on various factors. So good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Howard Bicker. I'm Director of State Investment Board. I've been asked to give a little history of the returns and a little bit about how we go and set asset allocation and project returns. I provided the committee with a little handout. I think the majority of you are familiar with the structure of the board, which is on page one, and the structure of the Investment Advisory Council, which is made up basically of members of the local financial community that we use and the board uses to help us implement various policy decisions. Page three is just, again, a brief snapshot of the assets under management. As of the end of the fiscal year, the board was responsible for $68.6 billion. You can see the vast majority of it's in the combined funds, which is the assets for the defined benefit plans. And the fourth page is the asset allocation, again, for the defined benefit plans. We have a very much equity-oriented asset allocation. We have basically 80% in equity-type investments and 20% in fixed income. Madam Chair and members, page five is the long-term returns for the State Board of Investment and, for that matter, the short-term returns. Last year was a pretty good year. We were up 14.2% last year. Yeah, you know, over the last 10 years, we are now still at 8.2% since 1-1 of 1980. And then people always ask why that date. Well, that's as far back as we have clean numbers that we can put together. So that's a little over 33 years. We have compounded at 10%. So you can see the returns are obviously very volatile. They will be when you're dealing in equity investments in the financial markets. Fiscal 9 was not a fun year, a negative 18.8. We almost moved from the third floor down to the second floor so people would not jump out of the windows, but it was not a fun time. You know, and at that point in time, everybody thought the world was ending. We basically stuck to a disciplined approach, and you can see the fiscal years since then, for the most part, have been very good. Page 8,
Before you go on, Mr. Bicker, sure. Why was there that drop in fiscal year 12? Did we have a little mini-recession that year, recurrence?
Madam Chair and members, timing is everything. June was a terrible month in that year, and we wiped out a whole bunch of the year's return. You know, if we would have had the fiscal year, ended on May 31st, I think we would have been 8.2. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you got to have a date. June 30th, it just happened to be a bad time. Page 6 is a review, whatever analysis, of long-term capital market expectations. We do this on a every 2 or 3 year basis. We will survey the street, the Merrill Lynch's, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, so on and so forth, and a number of consulting organizations. when we do an asset allocation study. The first column is the real rate of return. In other words, that's the return over inflation. The second column is the nominal. So in other words, you take the real plus inflation, and for this exercise, the inflation rate, historically, we have used is 3%. And you can see that the nominal return on our 2008 study was 9.36%. If you remember, in 2008, the world was still probably pretty good. It hadn't gone to heck in a handbasket yet. When we did this in 2011, the nominal long-term return had dropped 100 basis points, down to 8.36%. I point that out for a couple of reasons. One, as disciplined and as solid as these organizations are, the Goldman Sachs, the JP Morgans, the consulting firms, and so on and so forth, the reality is today's environment affects your long-term results or long-term expectations. The reality is a 30-year return should not change 1% on a three-year basis. But they're experiencing the market going down or the market going up or whatever. It's all factored in. The only thing that has maintained some consistency is the long-term expected volatility of the returns. And you can see the volatility or expected volatility for a total portfolio is around 13%. Now, you know, that's one standard deviation, two-thirds of the time. So, you know, we lose money some year. You expect to lose money. You also expect to make money in the long run, but as has been discussed by the commission, if you have a return assumption to meet, and we do, currently it's 8, you have to invest accordingly. And we have established a long-term asset allocation that we think has the opportunity to match that return, but there will be volatility involved. And people shouldn't panic when you have a negative year. It is expected. That is why also when you look at these plans, and if we ever all ever see 100% funded again, which would be nice, 110% funded is not something that you have to spend, because you know you're going to lose it. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that, you know, if you get overfunded, we got to spend the money, so on and so forth. If you have a return assumption of 8 or 8.5%, you're going to have negative years. You have to build in a cushion for those negative years. Unfortunately, in, you know, fiscal 08 and 09, we had some real bad volatility. I mean, that was when everything went to a correlation of 1. So bonds went down, stocks went down, everything went down. The only thing that hung in there a little bit was treasuries. Things are getting back. I mean, as the state's economists talked about, there is the new normal out there. Bill Gross, I think, tries to say he invented the new normal. You know, we listened to him drone on. You know, the reality is now he's talking about the new normal is changing a little bit. Madam Chair and members, what should be the long-term return for these retirement funds? The only answer I can tell you for sure is I don't know. And that's the truth. And, you know, when somebody comes up and we show 8.36%, the only thing we can guarantee you is that we will not hit 8.36%. We will be above it. We'll be below it. And in most years, we won't even necessarily be that close to it. But on average, over very long periods of time, with a equity-oriented, relatively aggressive investment portfolio, there is a decent chance that we will hit it. So, Madam Chair and members, that's just kind of a review of the history of the State Board investments, investment results, and a little bit about how we look at these long-term capital expectations on a regular basis.
Representative Kahn, thank you.
One question, Mr. Bicker. Do you ever invest in individual companies as opposed to brokerage accounts?
Mr. Becker.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, we buy a lot of individual stocks. We don't buy mutual funds except for state deferred comp. I mean, there is no reason for us. We can negotiate, you know, a quarter of the fee on an individual separate account basis versus a mutual fund.
Well, just one question then. Did you buy this environmentally attractive domestic automobile stock called Tesla?
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, I think one of our managers owns a little bit of it.
Okay, because one of the things that I recently learned is that a husband of a former legislator actually bought Tesla stock, and on the appreciation of the stock since he bought it, he's now bought a Tesla car, which is one of the most expensive cars in the country. So it looked like a good judgment.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, as I look at these rates of return over time since 1980, et cetera, that's extremely good performance. And as you say, I think anybody who understands this game at all knows that if you're shooting for an 8.5% rate of return, there's going to be volatility. So what I see from this is the people investing the money have done well. The reason that we find ourselves in these crises that we lurch in and out of is because the politicians are giving away too much money when times are good. Is that a fair generalization?
Madam Chair and Senator Thompson, I'm retiring in 6 weeks, and I still won't answer that question.
The silence speaks volumes.
Well, it seems to me, when I look back at the history, Senator Thompson, there, you know, we saw that we went above inflation. We talked about that yesterday in terms of during those good economic years when the stock market was doing really well. But we also reduced the amount that the employer had to pay during some of those years. So we did both. We gave extra benefits to the retirees, and we reduced the liability on the employer.
Being politicians.
Mr. Becker, yeah, political in both ways. Mr. Becker, the staff just had a question about the different individuals, BlackRock, PCA, Wilshire. Are those the nominal returns since 2011, or are they included in the 2011 study?
The numbers you have there are the 2011 study.
Is that your question? Okay. All right. Senator
Driscoll. Yeah, Madam Chair, you probably knew I was going to have a couple questions.
Of course.
I get teary-eyed over this stuff, folks. I'm sorry. Mr. Becker, a question for you. In the ups and downs and over the valley and through the woods that we see with investment returns, were you ever concerned in the 2009-2010 period of having to dig into the asset base to be able to make obligations? And what does the state do to prevent those kinds of selling assets when they're low because we've got more obligations than we have cash flow coming in or investment returns to be able to meet those pension obligations?
Mr. Becker.
Madam Chair and Representative Driscoll, right now, and for about the last 10 years, the state's negative cash flow. I mean, we always have to be in a position to liquidate securities and investments to meet pension obligations. The reality is the money coming in is less than the money going out. We have set up, and that's why many pension plans do not really allocate money to cash. We do. We have a 2% allocation to cash. And the reality is, generally speaking, when we are running low on cash, we will liquidate securities to get us to probably 2.5, and then we'll run it down to 1.5. That will generally run us through about a six-month period. So we always have to be in a position to be ready to liquidate securities. Also, the reality is we have 20% of our portfolio allocated to alternative investments, which for us are, you know, basically resource funds, mezzanine debt, private equity, that type of thing. That is illiquid for the most part. The other 80% of our portfolio, by next Friday, I could have it all in for you in cash.
Representative Driscoll.
Good to have it for us in cash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bicker, I was going to talk about the alternative assets in a little bit, but now that you brought those up, I'd maybe just move that question toward the top of the list. How are you able to determine the value? Are those mark-to-market so that you have a way to be able to help us to determine what the current value of those are versus what the state economists are talking about, book value, and Mr. Martin has talked about booked value on those kinds of things, which isn't always market value.
Madam Chair and Representative Driscoll, everything again now is mark to market. Obviously, Mr. Martin was talking about old accounting standards and so on and so forth. All our alternative investments are mark to market.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wanted to bring that forward because there was some real concern in this last market downturn that we've seen. As to what is the value of something. You put it on the books at $1 million and it may be worth $150,000, but you're still showing it on your official records as worth $1 million because you can't get a market price on that. And so the markets have, through regulation, moved away from allowing book value to mark to market, which means if it goes up that day, somebody's got to be able to put a value on that so that investors can have some transparency as to what those assets are. And that's a good thing for our pension, for our pensions, particularly when one-fifth of our pension assets, and I say our pension assets, our public employees and our retired public employees' assets are in alternative financing, that we can get a everyday end-of-market number and valuation on those. Madam Chair, another question, if I could, for Mr. Bicker as well. Mr. Bicker, as relates to some of the questions I was asking the state economist earlier this morning, if we have hyperinflation, which means that wages may go up as a result of this, how would that affect our ability to be able to meet pension obligations if we had hyperinflation? Our rates of return on assets, we're shooting for the 8.5% mark right now, but if we have some of that 70s and 80s hyperinflation where wages maybe have gone up 50% over a 10-15 year period of time, does that put pressure on us meeting the obligations? Because as an individual retires, typically their last 5 years are their highest 5 years of wage earning with the state, and that's upon which we base the pension payments. Comments, thoughts on that from your perspective,
Mr. Bicker.
Madam Chair and Representative Driscoll, you know, hyperinflation is kind of a two-edged sword. I mean, it would raise salaries, but also it will generally raise interest rates. So our return on fixed income would be, I mean, at once, you know, you get hit going up, but you would make a lot more money. I still remember I was used to run short-term securities, and I bought a 10-year treasury 14% coupon. That was pretty scary, but we did. So the reality is it's there's pluses and minuses. It depends on how it happens, because hyperinflation can happen different ways and have different effects on the economy. You know, I think the reality is for the most part, equity markets will do okay in inflationary environments because the corporations can have significant flexibility in their pricing. But the reality is it's generally not a good thing because retirees, especially retirees on a fixed income, get killed during hyperinflation. But the financial markets may do okay.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bicker, the reason I'm asking these questions is, and I tend to agree with your assumption that over a long period of time, 30 years, whatever that number is going to be, that we may have that 8.5% return. I'm worried about those peaks and valleys and over the woods and through the, through the valley and over the woods or whatever.
Over the glen or whatever.
I mean, you know, whatever metaphor you want to use on that. But the point being that we still have to be prepared for those days, those times, whether it be a 12 or 18 or 24-month period of time. And so I'm wondering, since today's discussion is around assumed rate of return, I'll ask you the same question that I asked the state economist. If we were to move that down from that 8.5 that we are now to, again, that arbitrary 6.5, 7, not advocating that that be what it is, does that help make your job easier and help to flatten out and build some predictability in here for, as we were told yesterday, over 10% of retirees in the state of Minnesota get a state pension?
Mr. Baker.
Madam Chair, Representative Disco, I mean, yeah. The reality is if you go to zero, my job's simple. I mean, you know, I mean, we can just buy some 10-year treasury bills and get the or notes and get the heck out of the way. You know, I don't think it's the goal of this pension commission or legislature or my board to make my job easy. My goal of what we do is try to do what basically you tell us to do, because you tell us what the discount rate is, and we have to operate around that. If we think we can't make it, we got to tell you. We're telling you 8 and 8.5 is probably as far as we really think we could push it. And, you know, and with the legislative authority we have, we can't be more than 85% equity type investment. So if somebody says, why aren't you 100? Because you guys won't let us. And that's probably not a bad idea.
What's not a bad idea?
Not to limit us to, you know, we can't have 100% in stocks or whatever. So, you know, the reality is the lower the discount rate, quote unquote, the simpler our job would be, or the lower our bogey would be. But, you know, we have done what we have done, and we will continue to try to do what you all basically direct us to do.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bicker is actually hitting on something that I think Senator Johnson brought up yesterday. Maybe we can just have him elaborate a little bit on that idea of the investment philosophy and where those investments are done. As I had indicated, I thought that he would talk to us a little bit about the fact that the legislature has put in statute what the investment policy is for the state of Minnesota. Maybe Mr. Bicker can background the commission on that if we're open to that this morning.
What do you mean, Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll, the legislative philosophy? State of Minnesota has it's Chapter 11A is our investment authority. You have, the legislature has described in that chapter what we can do and what we can't do. Some states are just the prudent person rule or the prudent expert rule. You know, you can do whatever you want within what an expert would do. The state of Minnesota has chosen to do what they call a legal list type deal. So anytime we want to change something from the State Board of Investments perspective, we must come to the legislature and ask for that authority. You know, there's pros and cons to both sides of that equation. But at this stage, Minnesota is a legal list state.
And, Mr. Bicker, would you say that that has served us well?
Madam Chair and members, I think for the most part it's fine. There has been some issues over time that we could have, if we would have had more flexibility, reacted to certain issues quicker, because it does take time, as you know, and it depends on. You know, something may happen in June that we may want to look at something, and now we have to wait till the session and go through all of that. But for the most part, it has not hindered the state investment board. Okay. The legislature has granted the State Board of Investment most of what we've asked for.
Are there cases in other states where the legislature, it's a two-edged sword. The legislature can intervene, you know, for political purposes, as Senator Thompson mentioned, that may or may not be, I don't want to say inappropriate, but that may not be as prudent. On the other hand, having tight legislative oversight can prevent the kind of flexibility that Mr. Bicker talked about. On the other hand, legislative oversight could prevent maybe unwise investments. And I think there was the scare, the junk bond kind of scare that's gone on in the past, where this looks like an easy way to make a lot of money quickly and may not have been so prudent. But you talked about the prudent person requirement.
Madam Chair and members, you know, there are pros and cons to this. The one area that I think has served the board extremely well to have legislative statutory authority is in the alternative area. And a lot of that's the real estate, private equity, venture capital, whatever. The legislation as it's written right now says that the State Board of Investment can enter into limited partnerships and so on and so forth. But we can only be 20% of a deal, and there must be four other players. We wrote that. We think that's a good idea. It gives other due diligence, so on and so forth. It also doesn't allow us, no offense, to build a stadium or to do other and sundry things because there's got to be four other players and 80% of the other capital. It has, you know, alleviated certain amounts of pressure to do certain things for maybe other than economic reasons. And this is by statute that was put in, and it has served the board very well and has served the state very well.
Representative Khan.
Madam Chairman and Mr. Bicker, do you ever compare yourself, for example, in that bad year like FY09 to the value-based investment companies like Warren Buffett? How did he do in that year?
Madam Chair and Representative Khan, to be honest with you, I don't know exactly what Berkshire Hathaway did. Warren Buffett's return is the stock market return of Berkshire Hathaway. I mean, he doesn't
show. Yes, I know. I just can't remember that.
You know, he has actually had a pretty bad run for the last 3 years, but he's done an excellent job. He's a very good investor. You know, in a year when we're down 18.8, I would have suspect he'd done better than us. I think last year we probably outperformed that stock.
Okay, any other questions for Mr. Bicker? Okay, we're going to have to figure out a reason to bring you back in a month before you leave in our next meeting. I'm sure we'll think of something.
If he's in 2 weeks, within 2 weeks, maybe he'll answer my question.
All right. Very good.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Becky Kretzinger from the St. Paul Teacher Retirement Association, and she is with RV Kunz Associates.
Good morning, Madam Chairman,
morning.
Members of the Commission. It's a pleasure to be here. We have a handout that hopefully all of you have in front of you that has a color box on the front. And the title of this is very appropriate. As you know, is 8% still a reasonable long-term assumption? First, to tell you a little bit about who I am.
Wait, we need Representative O'Driscoll here.
I'm sorry?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Just to tell you a little bit about who RV Kunz is, we've had the pleasure of doing some projects with the St. Paul system. And on page one, we talk a little bit about the firm. We were founded back in 1985. I started with the firm in 1994. We're independent, own ourselves, have about 110 employees today. And investment consulting is the only thing we do. We don't manage money or have any other lines of business. And we have 170 clients today. And we have several public funds of all sizes across the country. My bio's on page two. I'm the CEO. I've been the CEO with RV Kunz since 2008, and as I mentioned, with the firm since 1994. So I've seen some interesting market cycles since I've joined RV Kunz. One of the things that we do on page three is an excerpt of it, is a survey we take twice a year where we actually, on a voluntary basis, ask public funds to fill out a series of questions so that we can issue them a report telling them how other public funds are structured, what their rates of return have been, what their funded status has been, what their actuarial assumption is, and information about the expenses that they pay in the pursuit of that investment program. On page three, we actually give you the snapshot from our most recent report. This is data through the end of December 2012, and it's looking at a 10-year rate of return experience for these funds. And you can see the St. Paul system and their return of about 8.9% during this period of time. The median fund return was about 7.7%. And you can see that a 60-40 mix of the stock and bond markets is shown by the second horizontal line, and that had a return of about 7%. So we thought it'd be helpful to provide a little bit of historic perspective through the most recent time period, and we're working on the 630 data as we speak. This is actually 77 public funds that submitted this data. As we look at page four, one of the things that's very important that actually drives that performance experience is how the asset allocation of those funds has trended. What has been the general allocation to stocks and bonds and other alternative investments? You can see in the middle portion of this page, it's been about a 50% equity exposure, 26% in fixed income, 12.5% in alternative 7% in real estate and cash and other other less than 5%. So many of these plans overall in the pursuit of their investment goals are really relying a lot on equity and alternative investments to meet their goals. They're also somewhat differently oriented in terms of how they try to implement those asset classes. Many of the very large systems like Florida, like CalPERS, CalSTRS, Washington State Investment Board, they have so much money to put to work in some of these markets with, in some cases, hundreds of billions of dollars in their overall plan that they don't actually have the ability to pursue active management in some of these investments. They actually just buy a market representation of all the stocks in the U.S. stock market, all the stocks overseas. So they, in this pursuit of building a 50% equity allocation, they may not be hiring investment professionals to try to outperform those markets, but simply have a representation in those markets through something we call indexing. So as we look at the way they've achieved their returns that we showed you on the previous page, the biggest driver of achieving those returns is the asset allocation decision that you see in the middle of the page, and those are the trends you see there and represented graphically to the right. But they also have made varying decisions on how much we call active management they've built into the program to try to beat the index returns that come from the structure they've chosen. And, of course, the St. Paul system has a high degree of active management. But as I mentioned, many of the members of this survey have a lot more passive or index management in their structure. On the actuarial assumption front on page 5, we just show a number of assumed rates of returns, as you see the box there just below the top bullet point. And we show how many plans fall into each one of these actuarial assumption buckets. And you can see there is a large number of funds in the 8% bucket, 8% return assumption. There's also a larger number in the 775, and then there's another collection that we tend to see at 7.5. But the range really goes from that high of 8.5 all the way down to 6.5%. So we thought this may be interesting data as you're talking about the 8% to see where other plans were and where they were collecting. And we do take this survey and ask the actuarial assumption regularly over time and have watched these trends. And, of course, as folks have looked at the market returns since the financial crisis and have rerun their asset liability studies, we've seen them continually discussing this assumed return to see if there should be any action taken. Now, obviously, the action taken, if they choose to lower that assumed return, obviously puts pressure, as previous speakers have addressed, on the contribution side of these pension plans. And, of course, funding is very important. So as we look at that assumed return question, we know it's not just looking at the investment environment in isolation. It's also looking at the contribution side as well. On page 6, one of the points that we make at the top is when investment consultants like ourselves, and we're not an actuarial firm, we are an investment consulting firm, when we look forward into the future, we do it every year, but it's with a 10-year lens, basically. So if you think about a long-term or a very large book, textbook, that has 60 chapters, and each chapter represented a year in a pension plan, we're looking at the first 10 and just rolling forward our view at the next 10, the next 10, the next 10, to try to get a flavor for where we believe capital markets may be moving in that nearest term environment, not a short-term environment, a significant period of time, but certainly not over the life of a pension plan. As actuaries actually conduct their studies, they're looking over the long term of the pension plan. So there tends to be a bit of a difference between the consultant's view, which is nearer term, and the actuary's view, which is longer term. So sometimes that has led to a difference in assumed returns when an investment consultant looks forward and says, what do we think may happen over the next 10 years, and what an actuary is looking at when they study an entire pension plan's life. Some of those differences in the nearer term have led to differences in inflation assumptions. In fact, our particular inflation assumption has centered around 2.5% for the last couple of years, and there's a range around that 2.5% we expect in the next 10 years or so. And many actuarial firms have had a higher rate of inflation, 3 to 3.5%. So automatically, there's a bit of a disconnect, not only in time frame, but as a result of the time frame, a little bit different outlook on inflation. So in our particular case, as we look at our assumptions, we're looking at that nearer term and not seeing that hyperinflationary environment most likely, and in fact a little lower expected inflationary environment as your state economist represented. So that has resulted in, if you normalize just the inflation assumptions between the actuarial world and the consultants' projections as you look forward, automatically that starts normalizing the results to real return trends, which you can see at the bottom of the page. As you move to the next page, there's just some qualitative information about how we set our investment asset class assumptions, but I'll just have you turn to the numbers on page 8. This actually shows you, and I apologize, there's so many numbers on this page, but we wanted to give you a sense for the type of forecasting that we do. And this is something actually we look at every year. We get all of our investment professionals together in the fall to start looking at the year that we're experiencing and going backwards in history and looking at trends that we see in the marketplace and look forward at the same time. We set a full set of capital market expectations, as you see on this page. In 2012, you can see the assumed returns we were using. If you look at the leftmost column of numbers, the arithmetic return expected for global equities was around 8.4% as we looked at the world last year. And again, this is a rolling kind of 10-year and longer assumption. If you look past the first couple of gray horizontal bars, you can see fixed income had a return of 4.25. And all the way at the bottom, you can see cash with an assumed return of 2.25%. We aren't quite there today as you look at the rate of return or the rate you're getting on your money market balances in the bank. But long-term, we think it will center around that. And inflation at 2.5%. We update that in 2013 and then show you the changes on the right-hand side in pink. And if you just look at the differences year over year between our 10-year lens in 2012 and our 10-year lens in 2013, you actually saw some pretty dramatic changes as we looked at the fixed income market or the bond market going forward. And that really was trying to calibrate the reality of rising interest rates being nearer than further away. And that has played out to be true in 2013. This is just an example of how a consulting firm does look at this world, the set of assumptions that they set, and it is not necessarily representative of the amount of change in any one year you can expect from an investment consultant's view, but this was an unusual period of time where we did see the probability of interest rates going up being a very real reality. As you look at the next page, page 9, taking a look at St. Paul's plan, one of the responses to looking forward into the market and trying to find a more attractive way to mix investments to try to meet the investment goal over the long term has been a recognition that further diversification could be beneficial. And as you see the historical allocation on the left-hand side for St. Paul and the target allocation on the right side, one of the things that's very easy to see is that there's a lot more wedges to this pie. There's a lot more diversification that is planned going into the future. Such new areas such as diversified inflation hedging strategies, other alternative investments such as absolute return, expanding the private equity program, expanding the high yield program, and then, as you can see, still having a fairly heavy allocation to the equity categories generally as shown in that blue wedge. So we have helped many plans and crossed our client base deal with the future as they look forward by building even more diversification so that we're not so unduly dependent on one particular market and its success or challenge thereof. On the next page is just a risk return exhibit that shows St. Paul's program. This shows you risk across the horizontal axis, and it shows returns on the vertical axis. And you can see basically a number of potential portfolios numbered 1 through 10 that came out of our study of the most efficient way to combine asset classes together. You can see the plot points in the green box showing the target allocation that represents that more highly diversified program, and then the blue box, which is the historical allocation. Further, you can see that...
Ms. Gretzinger, we should tell you that we don't have the colored printout.
Oh, I'm sorry. I will speak to left and right. I should have remembered that. To the left box is the target allocation, and then the right box that you see, and it, with about a 14% risk, is the historical allocation. Pardon me for that, Ms. Chairman. So as you look at the assumed return, you can see where those boxes generally fall out on the vertical axis, and that is an assumed return somewhere between 7 and about 7.3, 7.4. Now, I should explain that those are assumed returns just investing in indexes where they're available and doesn't assume any value added from investment managers trying to outperform indexes. And it's also that most recent 10-year lens, not looking over the life of the pension plan. So this is just representative of taking a very conservative view of what we think the future may hold for the nearest term. And then on top of this, we would add additional value added by active manager selection in the program. And as I mentioned, there's a good deal of active management in St. Paul's program. This assumed return has changed over time as we've updated those assumptions. And you would have seen that had this been run some time ago, there would have been a higher return expectation for fixed income, and the assumed returns would have been a little larger. So again, this is something that we update every year, and just a snapshot in time to share with you. So in conclusion, on page 11, choosing that assumed rate of return for a public fund, as you know, has significant consequences, and it drives and informs the asset allocation decision that is made. And further, asset allocation is the biggest driver of investment results going forward, both in the return experience as well as how much risk or how much volatility those returns experience over time. We have found that prudent use of active investment managers that are trying to outperform their market segments or indexes is another prudent way to try to assume or try to produce additional return in trying to meet your target over time, and that we believe it's very important to maintain a long-term disciplined view as you look at the life of a pension plan. Thank you very much. I would love any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Driscoll.
Surprise, right, Madam Chair? Thank you for your presentation today. I have a question for you, and it's maybe just some clarification. Page 5, mm-hmm. We talk about public fund comparisons. Just to make sure that I'm looking at this, the sum 50 counties that you have on here, mm-hmm. That's from public pension plans from across the country.
Yes, and Madam Chairman, Representative Driscoll, that's correct.
So, Madam Chair, 17 of those public funds are at an 8% and 23 at about 7.75 and so forth.
Correct.
Okay. And then to follow up on that, you'd also said that many of these larger funds, like CalPERS and some of the others, mm-hmm. because they have hundreds of millions and even billions of dollars to invest, that what they do is they try to go out and replicate through individual purchases the index funds.
Correct.
Do you know, again, globally from your experience, those who are trying to replicate market performance, how are those pension plans doing as far as percentage of funding, rates of return, health? And I realize that there's another whole list of things that can affect that over there on this side, how the benefits are being paid out and they're calculated and some of those kinds of things. If you have any experience or could maybe speak to that type of an issue.
Madam Chairman, Representative Driscoll, that's a great question. There isn't necessarily a direct correlation between the degree of active management that they have and their level of funding, obviously, because there's so many other variables such as funding, and that is very different as you go state to state and then plans within the state. To explain a little further about the plans that have made that decision, they're faced with an interesting economic reality. If they wish to actually employ active investment managers, enough of them to be able to control the risk of the size of position or relationship that they have with any one manager, they have to end up hiring so many active investment mm-hmm. managers to control that risk and pay active manager fees that they replicate the index effectively. So at the end of the day, when you look at a net of return experience, they would be at a disadvantage there. So they have made that decision, especially in the markets where it has been proven to be more difficult to outperform for active managers, and that would be, say, in large U.S. companies. That tends to be arguably the most efficient marketplace out there. It's ironic, though, that we've just come through a cycle as we look at 2008 and rolling forward that active investment managers have had a difficult time adding value. So in some cases, the plans that did choose to index during a few of the years, as we look at the last five, they actually did a little better than active management because investment managers in many cases try to have a theory about why a stock will outperform, and it will be based on the fundamentals of that stock, such as the markets they're in, the market penetration they're in, their profit margins, how much their earnings are accelerating, for example, or an opinion on what the market value is for that company based on what the manager thinks an intrinsic value will be. And in some cases, since we've had so much sovereign intervention in our market, so much support from the Fed, so much macroeconomic noise going on, that those investment managers haven't been able necessarily to add value in every cycle. So again, that's just another consideration to say there isn't a straight line to draw between their funded status and their choice on active versus passive management.
Representative Driscoll.
And I don't know if members follow that, but that is a very, very important point that she just made, that in our internal rates of return for investments can be higher depending upon how we choose to purchase those assets. Mr. Bicker was talking about it doesn't make sense to go and buy a mutual fund because the state of Minnesota can go out and replicate that purchase at or near or even better cost for acquisition of assets and liquidation of assets than you might in some of the better known index funds out there. And as the testifier is saying, that embedded in these actively managed funds, there are expenses and things. So if a fund or a manager has a 1.5% expense, that's 1.5% less rate of return that we are receiving on those assets. So in the aggregate, they would have to, in our assumptions, return 9.5% for us to be able to get our bogey right now of 8%. And in the situation that Mr. Bicker is talking about, he may be able to go out and buy those at using technical terms, an eighth of a point in acquisition costs. So all he has to look at doing is returning 8.125% versus the 9.5%. And that's money off the bottom line for the investment. And that's one of the things that as an individual investor you should be looking at as well.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and Ms. Gratzinger, did you answer the question then? Is 8% still a reasonable long-term assumption?
Thank you, Madam Chairman and Senator Johnson. Absolutely. It's appropriate to say, what did you say? Yes, we believe it is still achievable, and we think it's achievable in the long term. We think that your actual experience as we look at the next 10 years, it's hard to say. We do know that any one specific number, if it's 7.02 or 7.49, we know that we're likely to be wrong on that. But we think the trend over the long term is good to make an 8% rate of return.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any more questions for Ms. Gratzinger? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, Madam Chairman.
Then next we have Don Leathers. Mr. Leathers, welcome to the committee. Would you like to introduce yourself for the members?
Sure. Chairwoman Pappas, commission members, council, and staff, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak today on the interest rate assumption. This is my first time testifying in front of the commission, so if I seem a little bit nervous, maybe I am. But judging from the credentials of the first three speakers, I feel like I'm batting ninth in the Twins lineup. And if I don't deliver a weak single to right, I'll either be sent to Rochester or asked to manage the team next year. I want to tell you a little bit about myself. My name is Don Leathers. I'm the legislative co-chair, or one of them, for the Retired Educators of Minnesota, or REAM, which is a group of roughly 7,200 retired teachers and school staff. who are deeply interested in preserving the defined benefit public pension program that currently exists in Minnesota, not only for retirees and active members, but also for those young people who entered the profession this week across the state of Minnesota. My job is to stay abreast of pension issues, report to the REAM Board of Directors and also local units, and then write a quarterly article about pension issues in the REAM newsletter. I'd also like to say before I get started that in the agenda it says that I'm legislative chair of REAM and also Education Minnesota retired. I believe that my views do reflect REAM, and I am a member of Minnesota Education Retired, but I'm not exactly sure if my views reflect their positions. I've been on the job for 2 years, and during that time I have attended TRA meetings, Board of Investment. I've also attended investment advisory council meetings and meetings of this body. And I've also spoken with and observed the heads of the various retirement funds, Mr. Bergstrom with MSRS, Ms. Vonick with PARA, and Lori Hocking with TRA, and the State Board of Investment Executive Director, Howard Bicker. And I've just come away with a great understanding of their dedication, their discipline, and their wanting to do what's right for Minnesota. Prior to my work at REAM, I taught for 33 years in the Albert Lee and Glenville Emmons school districts in southern Minnesota, and I have two children who are going to be future teachers, and I'm a proud beneficiary of a Minnesota public pension, so thank you. I'm before you today to offer testimony concerning the interest rate assumption, which was lowered from 8.5 to 8% a year ago, and the select and ultimate strategy designed after 5 years to return to 8.5%. REAM's position is to stay the select and ultimate course, be patient, let the reforms of the 2010 legislation and the investment take their effect, and see how it positively impacts our pension funds. I did hand to Lisa a couple of handouts. Of course, Howard presented you with this one, I believe, on the investment returns. I would just remind you that over the last, since 1980, that the investment returns have been 10%, and that I learned at the Investment Advisory Council meeting last week that in 1980, SBI's investment portfolio was less than $6 billion. Now it's more than $68 billion, so that's outstanding. And then on the second sheet, it says SBI returns compared to other investors. The top box indicates that consistently SBI pension funds have competed at the top tier with 161 other public and private plans. And then the bottom grid shows that consistently in different year increments that the SBI pension fund has outperformed the median public pension fund across the nation. So, and I believe that has to do with wise investing and a very disciplined approach to funding. Moving on, there are other factors that have contributed to Minnesota's pension fund rebound since 2009. As I mentioned earlier, the reform of 2010 called for shared sacrifice from retirees, from school districts, and from active members. The fund ratio for the three major funds have rebounded since 2009. MSRP from 66 to 86%, PARA from 60 to 77%, and TRA from 54 to 76%. As Mr. Bicker mentioned earlier, it would be nice to be fully funded. It would even be nicer to be at 110%. Our plans aren't totally healthy, but they're making good headway, I think. From REAM's perspective, lowering the actuarial assumption to 7% or lower would make our public pensions appear weaker. and would negate some of the painstaking work that you people have done, that the fund managers have done, and that retirees and other entities have worked to invest in Minnesota's future. That's why we support the Select and Ultimate legislation of 2012, which restores the rate assumption to 8.5% after 5 years. Further, Rehm rejects the claim made by some that, quote, accounting tricks are being used to obscure the size of the pension problem and hide the pension crisis from public view. Meetings like this show that that discussion is out in the open, it's public, and we'd like to say that the Minnesota public pension system is transparent, responsible, and open to all Minnesotans. And finally, we hold that Minnesota's public employees should be allowed to retire with reasonable economic security so that they can live their later years in pride and dignity. I'd like to thank you for listening to my testimony. I want to thank you for your deliberation during the interim on public pensions and their impact on all Minnesotans. I'd entertain questions.
Any questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Leathers, I was just wondering what communication you have with other states with the retired teachers, if you have conferences, if there's a comparison of what Minnesota's doing compared to other states.
Mr. Leathers.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, commission members, as I alluded to earlier, I'm kind of a rookie on this job, only been around for 2 years. I've had no communication with other states. However, in the middle of September, I'm going to go to Washington, D.C., and there I will have some discourse with other entities from all 50 states. And if I testify again, you ask that question again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rose.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason I ask Mr. Leathers is that I think sometimes it's wonderful to have these meetings and to you know, be proactive what we're doing with pensions, but sometimes it's good to sit back and look at what we have done and where we compare with the other states that are moving forward and have issues. And I think just in you know, I went to one of the Pew meetings on pensions, and that was Senator Roebling suggested I did that, and that was fascinating. I wish we could all go to one of the Pew organizations or foundations and get their briefing on pensions. And they think what we have done in Minnesota is astounding. It's an anomaly, and we should be very proud of what we did in the 2010. And as Representative Murphy mentioned yesterday, that was remarkable. So to have all the funds come to the table with an agreement and in a sacrifice was amazing. So sometimes I would like to have that comparison, what's happening in the other states, so we can keep it in perspective, mm-hmm. and make sure that we protect our assets and protect the people that we are having these pensions. So
I think, yeah, I agree with you, Senator Rosen. It would be, I think it would inform us and be useful to find out other states that are maybe in trouble, is what were some of the mistakes that they made,
right?
So that we can be sure to avoid them in the future. Mm-hmm. We certainly can't say we've been perfect,
no,
because we've made some mistakes in the past, and some of our funds were never adequately funded by the employer. So it'd be good to keep that history and other states' history in mind.
Madam Chair, and the benefits, just make sure that we are within the realm of proper.
What's realistic.
Realistic.
What's
right.
affordable.
Thank you.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any other questions for Mr. Leathers? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your comments. Ms. Crockett. Welcome.
Good morning. Kim Crockett, Center of the American Experiment. I'm here as one of the critics. As I said yesterday, that is my role here, though I will reiterate that I'm also happy to be a resource on the bigger issue, whether it's finding the Pew studies or, you know, Boston colleges that have been referred to earlier and others, I'm happy to do that for you at the commission. My contribution this morning is short, and I hope helpful to you, because I think all of this is very complex, and I've spent several years now studying the issue. And what I would add to the discussion just on assumed rate of return today is that I would urge the commission members not to just look at the snapshots in time on how the State Board of Investment performs for the pension funds. In the past, we've talked about focusing on how much money is actually in the fund at a given time. And I think Mr. Bicker referred to that somewhat this morning. Imagine if you only had $100 put aside in your savings account, but you had great returns that year. It still won't be enough if what you really needed to put aside was, say, $150. So it goes to the question of whether or not we've put enough away, and I think in some cases the state has not, and also, as Mr. Bicker referred to, the money that's going out. So are the benefits appropriate given the assets that the state has to spend? And I know that I was reading through Mr. Martin's memo today where he spoke on page one about how a defined benefit is paid basically no matter how much money is actually amassed. That's the word he used. You know, it doesn't matter what the magnitude of the dollar value of the trust fund amassed is, because the defined benefit is set by a formula. So what I would, again, underline it and I will repeat it, it matters how much money is actually in the fund at a given time when you're making those returns. So even if the State Board of Investment is the best investor of funds in the world, and I think at times we kind of think we have magic dollars here in Minnesota, even if that's true, you still have to have the right amount of money set aside in order to make the pension payments that you've promised to our retirees, right? I hope that makes sense. And Minnesota has not made its actuarial required contribution, I believe, since 2008. And correct me if I'm wrong, I may be off by a year or two. So what that means is that we have not put enough money into the funds during a time when the market also tanked. So in order to make up that lost ground, it would seem to me that you'd have to dramatically increase the contributions to the funds. And I agree that Minnesota did an excellent job in 2010 trying to fix the problem, but it may not have been enough. This is very difficult. You have to decide as policymakers how the pain of making up that lost ground will be shared. Because I think it has to be. You made decisions in 2010, and I know that you're struggling with making them again. And I will point again to the memo that was provided for today on page 3, and it's the generational, what I call generational theft or generational fairness issue, because we can't just focus on retirees. As the gentleman who was up here just a moment ago spoke, we have to also look at, the school teacher or the police officer who started her career today. And we also have to look at younger taxpayers who will never participate in a public pension system, who will only be members of the private economy. And I will quote from the memo, over the extended time period that public employee defined benefit retirement plans are financed, the goal is to ensure that the generation of public jurisdiction taxpayers that were served by the public employees appropriately fund the public employee retirement benefits accrued by those employees during that period. Here's the important part, without shifting costs to a future generation of taxpayers. So when we get behind, as we have, through a variety of problems, if we don't address the problem fairly quickly, what we've done is shifted on to younger workers, both in the public and private sector. So what I would emphasize for you as you consider the question of the assumed rate of return is that by leaving it at what is frankly an outlier rate of 8 to 8.5%, you are choosing to shift the pain primarily to future generations. You are not meeting the pension principle, which I just read to you, which is that you pay for government today with today's tax dollars. And finally, ask yourselves, why is the trend moving away from 8 to 8.5%? Why are there 41 funds who are at 7.25% or 7.5% today, including the big ones, CalPERS, CalTERS? They're down at 7.25%. So while I know it's more comfortable to say, hey, we've did a lot of hard work here, and Pew thinks we're great, and the woman who advises the St. Paul Fund says, yeah, we can hit 8, then why are these other funds trending down closer to 7? And what are they doing? Because they have the same problems that you do. In terms of coming up with more money right now in order to do 7.25 or 7. Why are those funds making that decision rather than staying at 8.5%? So thank you for having me this morning. And if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Very thoughtful questions. Thank you. Any questions from the committee for Ms. Crockett? All right, thank you very much. We'll return to this issue. This is just our first consideration, but now let's move on to number 4 on the agenda, the minimum salary membership threshold. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Martin.
Yes.
Okay.
Members, you have in your packet the last staff memo on the topic of PERA and its salary threshold and its membership inclusion and exclusion requirements. I remember a piece of legislation from 2 years ago that had to do with changing the dollar threshold. PERA for part-time employees requires that a certain magnitude of salary be obtained at least in 1 month for membership, and individuals who are below that salary threshold are excluded from membership. And the proposal in 2011 was to increase that threshold significantly, recognizing that it had not been revised for several years. Ultimately, that piece of legislation, as it was drafted, did not proceed in the commission. But by amendment, there was a mandate for a report from PERA to identify the options for revising the salary threshold. And the deadline date for that report was February of 2013. And PERA provided us the report. But the commission, because of the press of legislative duties during the session, did not have a full hearing on a full presentation by PERA on the report. So this topic is here, as I understand it, to at a minimum deal with that report and the narrow topic of whether the membership salary threshold ought to be revised. If the commission wants to go beyond that, there are potentially other membership inclusion and exclusion issues that may make sense or may merit consideration. This memo mostly the background items are here to give you a historical sense of the for the three major plans, both inclusions and exclusions. You'll note if you look at the memo that PERA has the greatest number of inclusions and exclusions and has had the most legislative modifications of those. TRA has the least, and MSRS falls somewhere in the middle. It just as a simple count of legislative changes. The last attachment, D, tries to take the current law and for the three plans and set it side by side to give you a sense of an either identical or analogous types of employees for inclusions and exclusions, trying to give you a sense of how the plans compare. So if Ms. Vanek is willing to make the presentation on the eligibility study, this would be the appropriate time, I believe, for the commission to consider the study. The study is in your packets. Has a blue 2012 color pattern up on the upper left-hand corner.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Ms. Vanek, welcome to the commission.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Mary Vanek. I'm the Executive Director of PERA, and I will be walking through the study with you today to point out some of the highlights. As Mr. Martin indicated, this study is a result of legislation that was proposed to increase our monthly membership eligibility threshold. Had not been touched since 1988. We had considered a couple of different ways to approach membership eligibility in 99 through 2000, 2001. We're not successful in making any changes, so we did welcome the opportunity to review this again. We did commission a cross-section of our staff to do some research and have some discussion. We worked with our actuarial consultant. We surveyed employers, and once we put together some thoughts, we met with a number of the employee representative groups to get their perspective on some of the ideas we had come up with. But one of the guiding principles that we used was the commission's principle that says, to the extent possible, membership in a public pension plan should be mandatory, and this is the key, for personnel employed on a recurring or regular basis. So we're really focusing on, it didn't matter if folks were part-time or full-time, if they had regular recurring positions that needed to be filled, that's what we wanted to make sure we were paying attention to. The objectives that we defined for ourselves for the study were to maintain the membership base near its current level. Significantly eroding our membership base would just increase costs because our overall payroll would be less, and so the cost to pay off our unfunded liability would rise. And so we were concerned about what kind of impact that could have. We wanted to establish rules that will maintain themselves so the legislature, the commission, can deal with this hopefully now, and it will self-correct or modify going forward, and we won't have to revisit this. We wanted to provide increased flexibility for employers, monitoring on a monthly measurement when most of us pay on a 26-week pay cycle, where pay periods cross months has been extremely burdensome for employers. One of our goals originally was to attempt to equalize coverage across the state because like positions in Greater Minnesota are not paid the same rate as positions in the metro area. That was one thing that we were not able to achieve, but we will continue to look at that. And again, administrative ease for the employers, and then also an opportunity for employers to more readily be able to explain when individuals qualify and don't qualify for coverage, because the monthly earnings threshold has not been an easy thing for employers to wrap their heads around in explaining that to our public employees and local government. Our statutes require that our employers report to us on an annual basis the individuals that they are not reporting to PERA. And when you have over 2,500 different employing units that you're trying to monitor with respect to this, it becomes a bit of a challenge. So we have designed some specific codes that they are able to use to say, okay, these folks aren't making the 425 threshold. These folks are full-time students. These are folks are seasonal. So they report that to us regularly. The pie chart on page 2 gives you kind of a breakdown, first and foremost, of the percentage of the participants in our plan that come from the various employers, those who are covered. And 7%, I believe it is, of our members in the general plan come from the school districts. And there is a large share of individuals in that group who are part-time, and yet they are regularly employed individuals. So participation is important to them. 24.2% of our membership comes from the counties. 20% from hospitals and nursing homes, or from cities, in the hospitals and nursing homes in townships make up a small amount. But if you look at the pie chart on page 3, that gives you a picture of the whole of public employment in terms of what we know of in local government. The exclusion reports I was referring to just a minute ago indicated to us that there are about 86,000 public employees in local government employment who are not reported to PERA.
So that means they're earning under $425 a month?
The pie chart shows you where they fall. It's about 6% of them are making under the 425. About 6% of them are full-time students who under our law are excluded. About 6% are temporary positions, which mean they're only expected to be in employment for about 6 months. About 5% are seasonal. Our law defines what seasonal coverage is that can be excluded. And the other 13% other exclusions, that's going to include independent contractors, interns, residents, folks here on a visa who are working, you know, just for a limited period of time. That area, I will tell you, is one that we want to dig into deeper because there are a lot of independent contractor reports to us of excluded. So we've got some work to do there. But this kind of gives you a snapshot. 64% of local government employees that we know of are covered by us. 36% aren't. So that was one thing that we thought was important for us to understand going forward. Page 4 gives you just a chart of the history of our earnings threshold. We used to just change this through an administrative bill. Periodically, we would review it. We'd bring forward an administrative bill to increase that threshold. Prior to 1961, an individual had to make $50 a month to be in the plan. That incrementally grew to 1988 to $425. And that's why we're here today, to see is that what level should that be going forward and what can we do about it. On page 5, you will see that in our study of other systems around the country, and we really wanted to look very much so at similar plans to ours, that 7 systems covered all positions regardless of their status. 10 systems used employment status, and in many of those we found that the employer defined what was part-time for purposes of whether they should be covered by the plan. And another 33 plans used employment hours for a specified period to determine membership. So we were really kind of excited that maybe we want to go to hours. And as I will tell you as we go forward, we landed that hours wasn't going to work for us. So it seemed like a way to meet our one goal of equalizing coverage across the state, mm-hmm. if it was measured on hours, not on pay, but we couldn't quite get there, unfortunately. So in our survey of employers, they were certainly supportive of us doing something. They had a wide range of opinions about how we could approach it. They certainly wanted the threshold to be raised to some level, but understood that we have a lot of constituents that we have to get on board with what we want to do here. So they continued to give us their opinions and check in with us every once in a while, and we put the report on our website and notified employers it was available, and that no decision had yet been made. We came up with options. We did not come up with a specific recommendation at this point. Our first option followed the proposed legislation. Increase our threshold from $425 a month to $737 a month.
Who's the author of that legislation, and did it come from you?
Madam Chair, the author, it was Representative O'Driscoll.
Uh-huh. And Senator Rosen.
And Senator Rosen.
And Senator Rosen, yes, and I apologize.
Did you think of it on your own, or did you work with some local groups that thought it should be raised, some cities or counties?
Well, Madam Chair,
do you want to share with us?
To your question, having come from city government and coming from local government, I had a lot of concern back in my district because of the 425 not having been adjusted for 25 years. There was local bookkeeping issues with that. You're in, you're out. We got to go back. We got to tell somebody 3 months afterwards because PERA is saying that person would have been covered for that month because of their wages. Now they got to go back and they've got to explain to that person that they have to write a check to the school district or the city for those kinds of things. So it's becoming a local bookkeeping challenge and issue, as Ms. Vanek has suggested as well. The fact that it hasn't been adjusted for 25 years and there is no mechanism in there to make that adjustment, we just felt that it might be time to be able to take a look at that. And I'm glad it's before the commission today to vet the issue.
Okay. Well, thanks for that history. Thanks. Ms. Vanek.
Okay, so as I said, we started with that initial proposal of going from $425 a month up to $737, and included in that so that it would be self-correcting going forward, that every time the CPIW increased that level by $100, we would automatically adjust. So it would, based on our history, it would be about every 6 or 7 years that would automatically adjust upward. The proposal did suggest it should be done annually. That would be incredibly burdensome for administration. It also did include letting people out if the CPI was negative, and it lowered that amount. And we did not specifically ask the IRS, but there are issues of bringing people in and out of a plan under the IRS qualified plan regulations. So we didn't vet that with the IRS because they don't like to answer what-if scenarios, but if we had something like that, we would have to get that clarified up front. We just know that it is an issue. You don't let people bounce in and out of a qualified pension plan.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. I'm wondering, you said, but I don't understand why that we couldn't use the hours for a specified period. Why wouldn't we be able to do that rather than the dollar amount?
Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair, Senator Goodwin, I will explain that.
Okay.
It would have been nice, but after discussing it with a number of the different constituencies, both employer and employee, we went away from using that, and I will explain that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your patience. Continue. So we looked at this. There was concern about using 25 years to over 20 years of history and jumping up so quickly. So while the employers didn't come in at a specific dollar value, in talking to the employee groups, there was definitely concern about jumping from $425 to over $700 a month in one fell swoop. We listened to that. We understand that. The other thing from the employer's perspective is on staying with a monthly threshold, again, is when you're working in a 26 pay period environment in 12 months out of the year, you're going to cross months, and they have to pay specific attention to what earnings fell in this month versus this month, and it is incredibly burdensome. The other thing that we talked through, and to Representative O'Driscoll's concern in conversation I had with him, it doesn't seem reasonable for somebody to exceed that monthly measure once and have to be in and then never meet it again. And that's what our current rules require. So we took that into consideration as we went through this also. Option two is, again, a monthly threshold. But we suggested that we increase it by $100 to $525, again, apply the automatic adjustment going forward. But it does have the same complication of the monthly monitoring. We did want to represent, though, that we're trying to make some sense of how this correlates to other information. And what staff found is that when we set our threshold at $75 in 1965, minimum wage was a dollar. And so that equated to 75 hours a month, which is about 17.3 hours a week. And when you take $5.25 and apply a $7.25 minimum wage, that equates to about 72.4 hours, or about just under 17 hours a week. So we're kind of consistent from where we started when we started using monthly earnings threshold to where we're suggesting today we go with this.
But the fallacy in that, though, is that one could argue that the federal minimum wage rate per hour is not really kept up with inflation.
Madam Chair, we don't disagree with that. And we do know that in talking to several of our employee groups that salaries for many of our members start above minimum wage. So, but we were just trying to wrap our heads around something related to this. We also looked at PELRA and the number of hours that are expected to bring somebody under the definition of public employee. And so some of the work that we did does actually get you there. Option three is, again, an earnings threshold, but we are suggesting we apply it on an annual basis. And the report shows using like $525 a month and then annualizing that. And then our analysis shows that it's actually, for a nine-month school employee, 73% of that value is more in line with what we would recommend be used. In discussing with some of the employee groups, we're bringing it down a little from what the report says. So the report tells you that we would use for a 12-month employee $6,300 for the business year, and for a school district employee who doesn't work the full school year, $4,600. If we apply a little bit lower threshold, that would be $6,000 and $4,400. And that was to address some concerns of some of the outstate Minnesota folks. But what we found is that we had the least resistance to making a change in providing an annual test. And the reason for that is, again, addressing Representative O'Driscoll's concern. If you have a liquor store employee who's filling in for somebody and exceeds the monthly test once and has to be reported, if you annualize the earnings measurement and they don't exceed the annual earnings, they're not going to be reported. And it also gives the employer a little bit more flexibility in saying, okay, we anticipate this is what you will earn. And we would recommend that if they do, in fact, pick up more hours or something occurs where they exceed it in the future, it is at the point that they exceed that amount and get reported that they have to start paying in. Under our current law, somebody can go over 425 in one given month, it not be reported, they don't catch it, and we go back retroactively.
Let me understand that, because I was going to ask a question about how this would work if you waited till the end of the year and then you did the deductions. But you're saying that people don't start paying, in the employer and the employee don't start paying into the pension plan until they cross the threshold? So for that first $6,300 or $4,600? Am I getting that wrong?
No, Madam Chair, I didn't explain that carefully enough. Our recommendation would be that if it's a full-time position and the expectation is that salary is going to be exceeded, you report them immediately, even a part-time position.
You report them and you do the deductions?
Yes. Okay. It is for an individual who you have told them, this is the time allocation we expect. We don't expect that you will exceed the earnings threshold that would put you into PERA, and therefore you will not be reported. If circumstances change throughout the employment year and they do, it is forecasted or they hit the point where they are going to exceed, maybe they picked up hours, maybe there was an illness somebody, you know, filled in for, now they're going to exceed that, then they get reported at the point that they hit that threshold.
Okay, you're using the word reported. Would you explain more about what you mean by reported?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Because I'm using the word deducted.
Yes. We would work very hard at explaining to employers that they have to make a reasonable interpretation on part-time employees that they will not exceed the annual limitation. And we would accept that, but therefore those individuals would not be immediately reported to PERA. If something occurred during the school
year. No, I understand what you're saying, but when you say reported to PERA, that's what I don't understand. Okay. Reported what that means.
Public employees, employers do not report on a pay period by pay period basis individuals for whom they are not required to make contributions. It is in one time a year that they send us a separate report that lists individuals who have not been enrolled for pension coverage, in which they then explain to us what excluded them from being reported.
So it's like an exclusion report.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So in discussing with the primarily the employee groups, bottom line is option three was the one that seemed to be the most acceptable. And option three also makes it clear that if individuals serve in multiple positions, would make it clear that if individuals serve in multiple positions for one employer, that all earnings would be taken into consideration for qualifying them. Under current PERA rules, I can work in a regular permanent job for an employer and also accept work as a temporary and not be not have those temporary earnings reported to us. And we're trying to make it easier and just say, if they're working for you, I don't care how many positions they're holding, if they exceed the earnings, they'd be reported. So we're trying to cover a lot of complications in our reporting rules and streamline them somewhat to move this forward. The final option was ours.
Let me just clarify again, though. Okay. Because I don't think you answered my question.
Okay.
Which is, if the expectation is from the municipality or the school district that they will not exceed the earnings limit. And so they are, but then they do. At some point they do. So then what happens in terms of, do they then, is their membership in PERA retroactive, or their membership in PERA in which they start paying toward their pension plan and their employer starts paying to their pension plan happen at the moment they exceed the earning limit?
Madam Chair, for an individual who is hired and the employer forecasts that they will not earn sufficient annual income to meet our participation requirements, the individual is not enrolled in PERA.
Right.
If throughout the year circumstances change and the individual does in fact get to our earnings threshold or it's forecasted that they will exceed that, they should be enrolled immediately and will continue in the plan prospectively.
In the future.
But we would not go back because we would expect that the employer would have documented that they made a reasonable effort to forecast the individual would not have qualified to be enrolled at the initial point of employment.
Is there an option for the employee to retroactively enroll? I mean, under this scenario, are you anticipating that?
Madam Chair, we have not considered that.
Okay. Senator Hayden, and then we'll go to option four just to.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Vanek, I was wondering if there had been any analysis or work done to look at who this would affect by ethnicity or race.
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, no. We do not collect that data. And I will cover shortly the number of employees we did an analysis of in terms of monthly thresholds who would be not in the plan today if we had the thresholds in place. So I can cover counts, numbers, but I cannot cover positions, ethnicity, gender. We don't look at it in that way.
So, Madam Chair. Ms. Vanek, I appreciate that. So is that because we don't know who that is, or it's just not something, a practice that you have looked at? And Madam Chair, Ms. Vanek, the reason why I ask is because a lot of times what my sense is some of these, a good number of these folks that are in the lower paying public sector jobs happen to be people of color. And so, I don't have hard evidence to suggest that. And that's why I'm asking the question and trying to figure out of the folks that would be affected, would there be a disproportionate amount of people of color that would be affected?
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, we have no reason to collect that data element on our membership. That has nothing to do with qualifying for a pension, for calculating a pension. So we do not collect that piece of data, and therefore I couldn't tell you where that may fall.
I wonder if individual municipalities or school districts have that data.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think it's worth us trying to figure out. We struggle with this opportunity gap all the time, and this is kind of part of that process. And so I think it would be important for us to see, based on where we go from here, if we're creating kind of a new disparity related to this issue.
Right. Mr. Martin is saying that maybe the associations, the League of Cities or the Association of Counties, has some kind of data by race or ethnicity.
Find out what the practice is.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay. Ms. Vanek.
To Senator Goodwin's earlier question, option four was ours. And we based this membership rule on two prongs: that the employer expects the employee to work more than 6 months per year, and the employer would expect the employee to work more than 780 hours annually if 12 months, and 525 hours annually if in the school district on the 9-month schedule. We looked at the various number of hours that employees work, particularly in the school districts, where we have a large share of part-time employees, and saw that typically they, 3 hours a day, so 15 hours a week, and over the school year, you multiply that times 35 to arrive at the 525 that we're using. So we tried to, make some rational analysis here and what should be applied. Many people were supportive of ours, and employers thought, well, this seems to make some sense. But
and that would really more significantly include the low-income earners, too.
Yes, Madam Chair. But if you look at the slide on page 12 of the two graphs, when it came right down to it, on the basis of part-time employees, they don't do a very good job of tracking hours. And so they would have to make significant modifications to then move to a different way of tracking who should be reported. Some of the concerns raised are listed on page 13 of the report. They just thought it meant – one employer commented it would be impossible to administer. Others said we'd have to totally program. Others said we don't calculate total number of hours. We'd have to rethink our whole approach. County's comment was it was difficult to monitor 780 hours. Some people, do they include personal leave? Do they include time off without pay? What are the actual hours? So when it came right down to it, And we did some checking back with a few of the employers that made comments. They really said, you know, we're used to working with a dollar threshold, but an annual threshold would probably be a lot easier for us than a monthly threshold. Comments I've heard recently.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Vanek, you keep talking of monthly, and you mentioned earlier that most of the municipalities that are on a two-week pay or a two-week pay period would be easier to calculate, or would it be just throwing another monkey wrench in if you went two-week pay period or four, the dollar amount earned in a four-week pay period as opposed to monthly. Would that help them out with their, or have you looked at that, I guess, is the question.
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, we did not, because not everybody is paying on a 26 pay period basis. I talked to outstate school representatives just yesterday and said there are still some schools who pay monthly. Okay. So, you know, the annual threshold really kind of covers everybody and makes streamlines it a bit, we thought. So we had a number of reasons why some things would work, wouldn't work, and where it came down to is that the annual threshold seemed to be the most appealing to anybody, and while not everybody endorses making any kind of change, they thought it was the most palatable change and that it would still include, for most purposes, a lot of the folks that we're currently covering, especially if we start lower and then automatically bring it up going forward instead of trying to catch up for over 20 years of not addressing it. So what does it mean to us on an actuarial basis? It would have cost us a fortune to have our actuary run every possible scenario, so the board asked us to limit it to something that was a reasonable representation of what we were talking about. So we looked at increasing the threshold from $425 a month to the higher level, $773. And what we found is that on a data file of just under 17,000 current active members who became members from the period 2002 through 2012, 4,200 of them would have been excluded because they would not have met the threshold. The financial impact of 4,200 fewer participants in our plan was negligible. There was no change in the normal cost contribution and no change in the total required contribution. So it made no difference whatsoever in terms of the contributions being paid to the plan. The other change we looked at was to base the threshold on hours, because we really were wondering if that would be, you know, when we initially went into this, we were thinking hours seemed to make sense. Unfortunately, most of our employers don't report hours because they don't have to. In 2001, when we were hoping to go to prorated service credit, we did ask people to start reporting hours, and so some do, some don't. We sent to the actuary just under 50,000 member records that had hours in them, but keep in mind we had not validated how accurate those hours were because we don't use them. The actuary determined that the number of employees with hours available represented 35.5% of our membership and that 8.8% of the data file had hours reported that would not have met the proposed thresholds in our document. So we determined, using those as proxies, that if 8.8% of our current members were not currently enrolled, our actuarially accrued liability could be expected to be about 1.9% lower, and the normal cost of benefits would drop from 6.84% to 6.83%. So not a measurable change in the cost of benefits by reducing the number of people enrolled under our proxy for hours. But again, we were a little nervous about this because we don't verify the hours that are reported and not everybody reports. So we did the best we could with the data we had in our system. and the effect on members that was requested. If you used, immediately went to the higher threshold based on the current entry age, the average entry age of our members, most members would have 19.7 fewer months of service credit earned because they would be enrolled that much later in the plan. And that's assuming retirement at age 66. And under the 525 threshold, about 7,700 of our current members would have an average of 11 fewer months included in the calculation of their benefits. So about a year less credit. Our conclusion was that using the annual threshold, whether it's 6,000 or 6,300 for 12-month employees, would maintain a fairly level, consistent membership number. Applying the automatic escalator would fix this going forward, and the legislature wouldn't have to deal with it again, and our employers and employees would know in advance what to expect in terms of what takes to qualify. The annual threshold provides far more flexibility for the employers because they can forecast and then deal with it going forward. It doesn't necessarily address our equalization, but one of the points, we just couldn't get there. And that since many employers, as I mentioned earlier, pay on 26 pay period, the annual threshold's easier, and employees can better understand. So it was trying to get through this study and meet the concerns of the individuals. I know that there are individuals from our membership groups that would like to address the commission. Some of them couldn't be here in August because of other commitments. I think that where we landed was that, as I mentioned earlier, the annual threshold is one that would not be opposed. And so if we decide that we need to move forward with this, we could certainly work through the details with the commission staff, but I'll wait until you have people.
We are coming back to this issue at our October meetings, and I do want to wrap up in 5 minutes. So I want to know two things. If people have any questions, immediate questions for Ms. Vanek, and no one has signed up to testify this time, is there anyone who can't be here in 2 months or is traveling from a long distance that would like to comment? Yes. Okay, why don't you just come to the table, and we'll see if we have any questions from Ms. Vanek. And please, I'd appreciate it if you do want to testify. I will give you the opportunity, as I do now, but it would be easier for planning purposes if you would let Ms. Dieslin know.
Okay,
any questions from Ms. Vanek, first of all, from members of the commission? All right, then, sir, go ahead.
Chair Pappas, commission members, I apologize as to my comments don't have to do with a specific item, but I came down from Duluth.
Could
I'm
you
Tom
repeat
Trinan,
your name, please?
A retired Duluth educator, and I came down to the hearings for the last couple of days just to hear what is being presented.
Sir, could you say your name, please, for the record?
My name is Tom Trinan.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Okay, now proceed.
I appreciate, Chair Pappas, that you arranged for these meetings, a chance to talk about this very important issue. It certainly is complex, and I've heard lots of great information the last couple of days. The fact is the pensions have been promised to Minnesota public employees. They morally need to be paid, and certainly are legally we're required to pay them as well. The other fact that we know, along with the unknowns, is that as of the last official report that I saw, there was a $16.7 billion deficit or unfunded liability to our pensions. And I know that we made up some ground because the market did well and the people who did our investing did a good job. But with a $16.7 billion unfunded liability, that comes out to $3,000 per Minnesotan. And just as a retired public employee, as a state taxpayer, I'm concerned about that. As we look to the future, and I listened with great interest to the interest rate assumptions, this really is an unknown. And if everything goes well, our unfunded liability is at the $16.7 billion. If it goes, if it's less than that, that number is going to grow, and it's going to grow greatly. And my big question is, who will pay for that? And as we have further meetings, are we making progress? How will we determine if that number is going to go down? As a person with friends who don't work in the public sector who are out there trying to make it on their own, They've seen their portfolios going down. They are having difficulty planning for their retirement, and I just want to be fair to everybody. As we look to the future, and I know that this is on the agenda, we talk about how we value things, about hybrid plans, about defined contribution plans. I think it's very important to take a look at that. Right now, even though it sounds like we were meeting our investment goals of 8%, we still have a $16.7 billion deficit or unfunded liability. I don't understand that. I'm not an expert, but I know that that still is an issue. So, in closing, thank you again for the meetings. We've got some tough decisions, and as a Minnesotan like the rest of you, I'm interested in being fair to everybody. I'm interested in being fair to public employees. I'm also very interested in being fair to our fellow Minnesotans, our friends and neighbors. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. O'Driscoll.
Chair Pappas, just one thing I would like to and Ms. Vanek doesn't have to address this issue now, but when we do revisit it, she was talking about that this was a very big undertaking, and I do appreciate the work that PERA did on this, Ms. Vanek, and I know from our conversations over the time that we've been talking about this and trying to size this up and figure out it's a major task. And I thank you and your group for doing that. Is there the question is, prior to 1988, when we did those 4 and 5 year increments along the way back to 1961, maybe your office has some data as to how they have addressed those in the past that you could share with us in the future to help us make a rounded decision on that. And again, if you aren't prepared and we don't have time today, in a couple weeks when we convene, maybe you could share that information.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I can't address that. We looked, and we didn't find anything that showed that. We could show that the 325 to 425 was driven by using some measure of inflation. But prior to that, I could find nothing in the records if that was the basis. I wish I could.
Is there any reason why this 425 threshold hasn't been addressed in the last 20 years?
Madam Chair, we talked about it in the late 90s. We tried to take a different approach in 2001 and actually move to including everybody in prorating service credit. But because we have so many part-time members in our plan who have continuously over the years had coverage, there were questions as to how we would actually apply that. So it got legislated, but then it was immediately repealed. And we didn't come back to it because actually we had put a lot of work into that and didn't succeed. And so we know that it's been something out there for a long time and hope that we could come forward with something. What we're comfortable doing isn't going to go as far as what Representative O'Driscoll had initially requested, but we believe that if we can get support on moving somewhere and then having an automatic provision going forward, that we can get there. I did want to point out to the commission that in the materials there's a lot of background information. Please keep in mind that PERA is local government. That means townships, cities of all sizes, non-teaching school district employees, counties of all sizes. There are a lot of varying positions that are used in local government and miscellaneous joint powers boards are covered by us. So when we try to compare what MSRS, which has very similar positions, state employees, yeah, different jobs, but state employees and teachers, you cannot do apples to apples comparisons in the types of positions we cover. So we have had to be more flexible. And why we arrived at a monthly earnings threshold, I don't know that either. But we are there. We have been there since 1961. And so if we can do something to reasonably modify this going forward that's reasonable for local government and for the members who are counting on that us, we hope we can accomplish something with you.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Vanek, I'm wondering what would happen if you grandfathered in all those people that are making 425 and you went up to 723 or whatever that amount is. but your grandfather's in, so they're not actually stopping their contributions and their employer contributions. But for the new employees that come in, they start at the 723, or they have to make that additional amount. That seems like a fairer system that would solve the problem eventually. But I mean, if this would have been attached to the CPIW years ago, then we wouldn't be where we are right now. But it wasn't. That wasn't done, and so we just look like, from what you're saying, that we just kept changing the dollar amount kind of randomly sometimes, and other times along with the inflation rate. So have you looked at that? Have you looked at what it would do to continue these employees that are already getting, that are in the pension plan at 425, and then just starting all the new temporary, short-term, whatever, at the 7-something level?
Is that what you address on page 15, potential grandfathering of current members?
Yes, Madam Chair. Nothing that we're proposing would suggest that anybody who is currently in at 425 would be excluded going forward. They would stay in under the rules that apply.
Okay.
While I answered earlier that we didn't necessarily have documentation to show that our changes were tied to CPI, if you look at the chart, they seem to have some measure of inflation as to the points where we made our changes. And on your other part of your question, Senator Goodwin, the analysis we did show, I think it was, 4,200 people that wouldn't have been in our plan if we had gone to the higher threshold, if it were already in place. I think you need to speak to the employee groups. They are concerned about that immediate jump from 425 to $700 and some dollars a month. And what they know of in their constituencies of people who otherwise would have expected to have the coverage and then would be immediately excluded without an opportunity for people hired going forward. So I think what we were trying to do is arrive at a compromise that would move the needle somewhat and then automatically move it in periodic increments so that we don't have this question of, arbitrary discussion at some point we're going to change it or we're not going to change it.
Okay, well, we're going to wrap up for now. Our next meetings are September 11th and September 12th, and we'll have the agenda sent out so you know what we're talking about. And please let us know if you're going to be here or not. And thank you very much, Ms. Vanek, for the report, and we'll return to that in a few months. The commission is adjourned.
Two things.
It used to be, if you work more than 90 days for a public employer, you were having to be considered a new employee and then you had to be brought in. So what they would do is they hire
people. I assume the commission always has all these.
89 days and then a week later they hire back for another 89 days.